Usually when we talk about going to the office, there's this this expectation of physical boundaries. You walk through the glass door, sit at your desk, and the company just points and says, there's where you work.
Right. Yeah. It's totally physical. And it's comforting in a way because we generally like our work and our home to be clearly categorized.
Exactly. But then you step into the world of remote work, and suddenly that whole office building just vanishes. I mean, we're looking at a professional landscape that is like incredibly murky.
Oh, it is the absolute definition of blurred lines.
Right. So, welcome to this deep dive. Today, we're looking at Work Package 2, or WP2, of the Remaking Project. And their mission is to uncover what actually happens when the walls of that office disappear.
Yeah, they're really trying to figure out how remote work genuinely impacts our lives. So specifically looking at that incredibly delicate balance between well-being, productivity, and work-life balance.
And if you currently work remotely, or maybe you're considering it, this isn't just academic theory for you. We're looking at the invisible forces shaping your daily routine and your mental health right now.
Definitely.
Okay, let's unpack this. Is remote work the ultimate life hack for freedom, or like a hidden trap for isolation?
Well, to figure that out, the researchers behind the Remaking Project, they started by looking at who actually gets to work remotely in the first place. This was their literature review task 2.1, and they use what academics call an intersectional lens.
Wait, what does that actually mean in this context? Because when people talk about remote work, it usually sounds like this, great equalizer. Like everyone is just a square on a Zoom screen.
Exactly, but that's the illusion, right? An intersectional lens means recognizing that those squares on the screen, they hide completely different overlapping realities based on gender, age, and socioeconomic background.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, like working from home means something vastly different for a 20-something single person with a quiet, dedicated home office versus a parent sharing a cramped apartment with toddlers running around in the background. Or even considering who gets excluded from remote work entirely.
That makes perfect sense. Remote work might totally empower one person, but completely exhaust another just based on their living situation. But how do you actually measure that?
What do you mean?
Well, if you just send out a mass survey, how do you capture the difference between the guy in the home office and the mom in the kitchen?
That's the exact problem with relying entirely on numbers. If you only look at survey data, what researchers call econometric regressions, where they try to mathematically isolate variables in task 2.2, you miss the human nuance.
Right, because you can't just put a number on the stress of a toddler yelling during a meeting.
Exactly. So they don't just use surveys, they use a rigorous mixed methods approach. They combine the math with extensive qualitative on-the-ground observation in task 2.3.
Okay, so they actually go to where the work is happening, like field biology, but for remote workers.
Precisely. They do 20 interviews per area, they run focus groups, and they literally spend 2 months doing participatory observations. So they sit in co-working spaces, cafes, people's homes, and even camps, just observing.
Wait, a cafe makes sense, but camps? That's a pretty stark contrast to the typical laptop on the beach image of remote work.
It really is. By going out into the field, they can contrast totally different realities. They're specifically comparing lifestyle migration. Think of your digital nomads who actively choose to travel against enforced migration.
Ah, so people who are working remotely because they've been displaced or forced by economic
Yeah,
circumstances.
exactly. The psychological impact of remote work for those two groups is entirely different.
Okay, so you take all these massive surveys measuring stress variables, and you combine them with months of sitting in cafes and camps watching people actually work. Where does all of this diverse data across these four case studies actually go?
Well, it all funnels into task 2.5. They produce a comparative integrated analysis to identify the real-world ripple effects, the positive and negative externalities of remote work.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And the ultimate goal is to produce a thematic policy brief and peer-reviewed publications. They want to give governments a clear picture of what's actually happening on the ground.
So, what does this all mean for you? Well, these policy briefs aren't just going to sit in an academic library. Governments are currently scrambling to figure out the rules of this murky landscape.
Right, they really are.
And the findings from projects like this could directly shape future labor laws governing exactly how you are allowed to work remotely.
Because they're trying to figure out how to regulate this space to protect workers from burnout and isolation.
Which brings us back to that missing office building we started with. I mean, we wanted to tear down those walls. But if future policies strictly regulate remote work to enforce healthy boundaries and prevent isolation, will we eventually lose the very flexibility and, you know, boundary blurring freedom that made remote work so appealing to us in the first place?
That's a great question.
Definitely something to think about the next time you open your laptop at the kitchen table.